10. Liberty Day. She cleans her face and hair of Killebrew's gore in the bathroom of a gas station a few blocks away. The cashier freaked when Haley walked in, blood spattered as she was, but Haley smiled as if nothing at all was amiss and received the bathroom key with a wink. News of the double shooting appears on her phone's newsfeed by the time she climbs back inside the car. The victims are not yet identified. She estimates the police investigation is only now getting underway. The Pentagon will weigh in, of course. A perfect shitstorm will ensue. But will the load-in of materials and supplies for Operation Battlecry stall with General Killebrew's death? She doubts it. The military exercise is a multinational effort involving the cooperation of several NATO allies. Pogue was right. Killebrew's demise will stop nothing. It's 7:30. The evening sky has darkened, heavy with a roiling mass of matte black clouds. Wind swirls, kicking up dust and debris. Rain hasn't fallen in the area for weeks. Haley turns the ignition and drives back into El Paso, finding a budget motel not far from the Beverly Crest Motor Inn. Super Lodge Motel is also on Dyer Street, but 2 miles north. Checking in and parking, she doesn't bother entering the room. Haley only needs a place to lie low for the night. She takes residential streets east of the main drag, doubling the walking distance between the two motels with a zigzag route, but keeping out of sight. A scruffy cemetery and busy car wash are located directly across Dyer from the Beverly Crest. Between those two addresses is a cement-lined storm drainage ditch that Haley accesses from Guadalupe Drive. The culvert is deep enough so that when she approaches the busy avenue, she is below ground level. With a gopher's eye view, the deeper state operative has a good vantage point on the entire motel parking lot and surrounding street. Identifying the hit team's vehicle is trivial business. Parked in the same location opposite the motel driveway that the man in black had favored is a dark blue 90s model Chevrolet Suburban. Haley sees one operator behind the wheel of the generously dented SUV and another in the shotgun seat. More men might be sitting in the back seat, she's not sure. Despite the dying light, they wear sunglasses, a fact that brings a grin to Haley's face. The men, white, short hair, wearing civilian clothing, talk easily among themselves, passing the time, waiting for her. She isn't surprised the man in black, having been badly humiliated, has passed the job of eliminating her to others. With their action movie eyewear and lax security measures, the hit team impresses Haley as near amateurs. She doesn't take it personally. Given the scope of the conspiracy, the deeper state operative is the lowest of priorities. Without a doubt, the men have searched her room already. Haley is reasonably confident the envelope containing the ciphered pages is still safe, secure in its hiding place. However, her clothes and personal items in the motel room have clued the hit team to her inevitable return. They won't be leaving their stakeout of the Beverly Crest anytime soon. So, how to retrieve the encrypted pages? Backing away from her vantage point, Haley turns and walks quickly back up the drainage culvert. She has much to do in the next several hours. The pieces are falling into place. Roy Pogue's cell phone was a treasure trove of information. She had accessed the device after driving only a few blocks east on Airport Road, away from Penny's Diner. What motivated the CID agent to give her the phone's unlock code? His fringe separatist movement shared only racial bias with the group that Killebrew had joined. Cooperation between the two groups was fraught with tension from the beginning, their mutual enmity an obvious stumbling block. Haley will never know if it was Roy Pogue's hatred of Killebrew, a disillusionment with the separatist fantasy, or some emerging affinity for her that compelled his change of heart. Ultimately, it makes no difference. Maybe it was a merging of all three impulses. Moments before his demise, Roy Pogue decided to die a patriot. 9966 accessed the phone and revealed all of its secrets. One photo in particular was more shocking than any other clue contained on the cell phone's storage chip. Haley had learned the identity of the secessionist plot's true leader. But also revealed was a path forward of taking him down. The fast food meals he has consumed over the past 20 hours have left several stains on his Punisher t-shirt. Jack in the Box, 7-Eleven coffee, more Jack in the Box, and even more coffee. The hit team's driver and de facto leader is sick and fucking tired of sitting in the Suburban with the other three guys, inhaling their bad breath and all too frequent farts, listening to their inane conversations and intermittent snoring, waiting for this stupid bitch to show up. Haley, whatever her fucked up fucking name is, Thrill, Pill, Kill, who the fuck knows or cares? Let's get it on already. Around 8 a.m., while everyone else in the SUV is still asleep, Busby watches the housekeeper making her rounds. To be honest, a nice piece of ass for a hotel maid. The hired hitman, his last job as a motorcycle mechanic at the local Harley-Davidson dealership, a victim of the pandemic and subsequent crash in oil prices, entertains a brief notion of jacking off to this dizzying sight of the maid's butt while the others sleep, but dismisses the thought just as quickly. Busby is anxious to make a good impression on his new employers, whoever the hell they may be. The dude who hired him, wearing all black like some kind of low-rent Johnny Cash, had approached him at Mulligan's on Dieter. This guy in black, no name, 60 maybe, bitching about his lower back half the time, promised more work if this job was a success. Born Henry Thomas Cahill, Busby is a probationary member of the Kinfolk Motorcycle Club. Most of the guys in the set barely tolerate the wannabe biker outlaw, but he's willing to wait them out. Getting a reputation around town as a cold-blooded killer for hire is a fast track, Busby imagines, of getting patched. The other three guys in the 15-year-old GMC are also vying for their club colors. Forever kinfolk, kinfolk forever. They're armed, of course, with cheap 38s, and Busby's newer Glock 17, stolen from an ex-girlfriend's ex-boyfriend's pad. Their instructions are straightforward enough. Kill the blonde on sight, then skedaddle. The guy riding shotgun sits up, blinking against the morning sunlight, registers Busby's alert attention. What the fuck is happening? Something, I hope. The blonde guest with the friendly smile approached her car at a stoplight on Dyer, a couple of blocks north of the Beverly Crest. Lena Campos was already a few minutes late for work, her daughter, Diana, fussing and resistant to being dropped off at daycare, and so any further delay was irritating. Lowering her window, Lena made no effort to mask her impatience. The blonde woman wasted no time getting to the point. Hearing her out, the room cleaner made her decision before the traffic signal changed. Now, an hour later, as she approaches Haley Chill's room with the cleaning cart, Lena wonders if she has made a mistake getting wrapped up in this crazy business. The Chevrolet Suburban, as anticipated, is still parked across the street. Lena can feel the driver's eyes on her as she walks toward room 32. How will the gunman respond when she stops to enter? She could have refused to help Lachelle, despite what the motel guest had done to rid Lena of Jerry Fishball's vile harassment. But in truth, the undocumented Honduran volunteered for this more hazardous operation. Haley had requested only that the housekeeper confirm the envelope was still in its place until a better plan could be devised to retrieve it. Lena offered to do more. She owes the blonde woman that much. The Honduran stops at Haley's room door and knocks, announcing her presence with the expected declaration. Housekeeping! Waiting a few seconds, Lena opens the door with her master key. Leaving the cart outside and the door open behind her, as is customary, she enters the room. Judging from the disarray, Lena surmises the men searched the room at some point the previous night. She glances at the front window to her right and sees damage to the frame that suggests a method of forced entry. The men know the condition of the room, that cleaning it is next to impossible. When hotel staff encounters disarray of this extent in a room, a change of bath linens is the most a guest can expect. The men in the Suburban are aware of all of these things. She hasn't much time. Busby and the others are on the move moments after the motel housekeeper enters the room. Triggered by Lena's presence, and in no small part because he's sick of doing nothing, the out-of-work motorcycle mechanic is determined to act decisively. He isn't going to earn his patch by drinking convenience store coffee for another 20 hours. The wannabe hitmen jog across Dyer and toward room 32's open door. If anyone inside the office is watching, there's little expectation of them interfering with this crew. They may only be prospects, but they look the part of motorcycle outlaws. Lena steps outside with an armful of dirty bath linens as the men converge at the door.
Get in the room!
One of the other men knocks the dirty linens out of her arms. Lena seems far too quick to crouch down to gather up the towels again. Before she can gather up the linens, another man pushes her on her ass.
What do you got in there?
Lena scrambles to her feet again as the thug bends over to search the towels, casting them aside as he inspects each one.
What do you think you're doing?
Busby demands. The housekeeper crosses her arms over her chest and hunches her shoulders, girding for attack. Her silence is all the more damning. Busby takes a threatening step toward her, pushing Lena against the wall.
Fucking bitch, you're hiding something!
He slams his fists down on her crossed arms, knocking them apart. Two of the other men put hands on the housekeeper. She struggles to break free of them. One of the men has run his hands across her front and around to her backside. Shakes his head.
She's got nothing.
Busby feels his bravado siphoning off. Lamely, he says,
This bitch is hiding something.
Gilipollas!
Lena pushes past Busby and the other men, exiting through the room door and striding up the walkway. Approaching the rear of the motel from the west, the deeper state operative remains hidden from view. Though the men in the old Suburban were amateurish posers, they were still a threat. Even stupid can kill. The weed-choked lot behind the motel is strewn with trash, broken furniture, and empty paint cans. Haley stops below the bathroom window of her room.
Come on, let's get the fuck out of here.
Haley listens as they troop out of her room, their disgruntled voices receding as they retreat into the parking lot. A few moments later, Lena's head appears in the bathroom window. She passes Haley the envelope retrieved from its hiding place deep inside the room's heating duct.
Thank you.
The room cleaner nods in response, her head quickly dropping from view. Haley remains below the window for a few seconds longer and listens to make sure Lena is okay. It is a needless gesture. As throughout her life, the room cleaner is more than capable of taking care of herself. The undocumented Honduran will work at the Beverly Crest Motor Inn for another year, long after the colossal events in which she had tangential involvement pass into the history books. Securing an assistant manager position at Teddy's Flame Room, she will quit the housekeeping job, accepting with it a living wage and health benefits. The man Lena meets there, a U.S. citizen born in Honduras, makes good money as a builder in Boulder, Colorado, and she will subsequently quit the bar manager job, too. Her daughter, Diana, will graduate from Fairview High School and attend the University of Colorado, Boulder, as a pre-med student. The former motel housekeeper's life will be indisputably good, one built upon the all-American foundations of opportunity, hard work, and perseverance. No part of that bright future would have been possible had she failed to help La Chele in a moment of tremendous need. To her dying day, a winter Sunday morning following church in the year 2100, exactly 100 years after her birth in La Ceiva, Honduras, Lena Campos, the matriarch of a proudly prosperous American family, will remain unaware of the pivotal role she played in securing a future for herself and Diana, as well as every man, woman, and child in the country. Oswald was reluctant to delegate the responsibility of assassinating Haley Chill, preferring to do it himself. But General Killebrew's shocking murder by another conspirator, a CID agent by the name of Roy Pogue, has the potential of throwing operations into disarray. What had prompted a deadly argument between the two men? Leaving Sierra Blanca and driving east on the interstate for an emergency meeting with Woodside and other high officers of the cabal, Oswald runs the possible scenarios in his head. The alliance between white and black nationalists in a movement that envisions a two-state solution is not a dependably easy one. Distrust pre-exists between the two groups. But natural foes can work together to pursue a common goal, right? Liberation. Did Killebrew and the black CID agent have a personal beef with each other? Legitimate law enforcement authorities, including some sympathetic to the cause, investigate that possibility. Time will tell. He considers another possibility. Was Haley Chill somehow involved? the two junior officers who accompanied Killebrew to the diner in Santa Teresa, not participants in the movement and unaware of its intentions, provided similar testimonies. Killebrew had excused himself to go to the restroom. His failure to return after several minutes prompted them to go in search of him. The young lieutenant found the two dead men in the dumpster enclosure at the rear of the parking lot. A waitress corroborated what the army officers reported. The only other customer in the cafe at the time was a woman loosely matching Haley's description, unavailable for questioning and still unidentified.
Something doesn't seem right.
Oswald continues to brood as the miles of flat Texas landscape fly past his window. The men he hired to take care of Haley Chill reported that she hadn't checked out of the budget motel on Dyer Street. Their instructions are to continue their surveillance. Oswald is all too aware of their probable ineptitude. With the operations jump off only hours away, time and manpower are suddenly in limited supply. The first rail cars from El Paso are due to arrive in Sierra Blanca within the hour. Personnel is in place at the rail yard there. He hasn't a clue if he'll be successful in eliminating the threat posed by Haley Chill. At the very least, Oswald imagines he has placed additional obstacles in her path. But if she was somehow responsible for the death of William Killebrew, one of the cause's most important actors? Well, then perhaps he and the movement are truly fucked. Her attire, acquired the previous night, suggests an evolution of tactics in her investigation. Unable to retrieve a change of clothes from her room at the Beverly Crest, Haley went shopping at a Walmart supercenter on Gateway Boulevard. Besides a couple of changes of underwear and socks, she purchased a cotton camisole and men's flannel shirt, Dickies carpenter pants, Merrill boots, and a Levi's denim trucker jacket. More comfortable, in more practical clothing, Haley has shed her cover identity as a Senate aide. She arrives in Sierra Blanca shortly after 2 p.m., driving past Delfina's, Haley recalls her meal there 4 days earlier, remembers meeting the sheriff's deputy and aspiring crime novelist, Jay Gibbs. Would be nice to stop in for a bite to eat. Even better if, by chance, Gibbs has also stopped in. Almost in the same instant, the deeper state operative rolls her eyes in reaction to these frivolous daydreams. Who is she kidding? Haley glances to her right, toward the old man sitting next to her in the front seat. Thank God that despite Juan Lugo's many talents and skills, reading minds is not one of them. She focuses again on the matter at hand, attention jogged by a glimpse of the M1 carbine the old man cradles in his lap. Traveling on the Union Pacific Sunset Route, paralleling the interstate for much of its journey between El Paso and Sierra Blanca, the massively long train is visible from the roadway. 7 diesel-electric locomotives interspersed through the train with a total length of nearly 3 miles. More than 500 double-stacked container flat cars and wagons laden with the 1st Armored Division's supplies, vehicles, and material roll east across the Rio Grande Valley. From Sierra Blanca, the train can switch to a line that follows a southeasterly direction or transition to the northeast on the Fort Worth line and into the heart of the Permian Basin. The first 12 rail cars have passed over the crossing Archie Avenue, where the two routes diverge, as Haley pulls the rental car into the lot of the Pecos County State Bank, parks, and gets out. Her companion, weathered brown skin and eyes like galactic black holes, expressive of a sadness so profound that no light can escape them, gets out of the car as well. Having left the carbine on the vehicle's front seat, Lugo slips his pristine, ivory-colored Cavender's straw cowboy hat on his head and follows Haley across the parking lot to the crossing on Archie. The deeper state operative stops and watches the passing massive freight cars roll steadily past, heading east and shunning the tracks that peel off toward the south on a rail line that leads to the port in Houston. What she feared has come to pass. With the train diverting from its planned route, one dictated by the Pentagon under Operation Battlecry, the secessionists have hijacked an entire army division for their traitorous activities. Retrieving her smartphone, Haley takes a short video of the train's movement due east. She will send it immediately via encrypted text to Andrew Wilde. But what can Publius expect to do now? Can anyone stop rebels who are backed by armored elements from both U.S. Army and National Guard? Nothing Haley has witnessed in the past week suggests that enlisted personnel are party to the rebellion. Rather, the conspiracy seems to be the concerted effort of a small cabal much higher in the military hierarchy, a plot that is enabled by civilian sympathizers. And at the top? Something worse, she has learned. A politician. Haley has seen enough. She gestures to the Hispanic middle-aged man who stands mutely beside her, watching the passing train. Let's go. The old man, wearing a plaid shirt, Bodhi wool vest and dusty canvas pants, nods and turns for the car. But Haley hesitates, reaching out and touching the man on his elbow. He turns to face her again. You sure you want to do this? It will be dangerous. The old man, who has spent a lifetime outdoors and mostly without the company of others, as is his preference, says nothing. His eyes speak for him. Haley doesn't think she has witnessed a greater resolve than the one she reads on his face. They walk back to the car together. Juan Lugo worked at the spread for 20 years before being fired last June. The JW7 ranch in the Davis Mountains is 37,000 acres of open and mountainous terrain, sitting on top of the Capitan Reef Complex aquifer. The main residence, built in 1890, is a 10,000-square-foot stone edifice renovated with every modern convenience. The trophy Bass Lake, within view of the wraparound porch, is spring-fed. U.S. Congressman James Woodside bought the ranch out of foreclosure in the depths of the pandemic a few years earlier and resides there when not in Washington, D.C. Lugo, a loyal and beloved employee of the previous owner, clashed with Woodside over various issues, not the least of which was the congressman's decision to sell an excessive amount of the ranch's abundant frack water to operators in the Permian Basin. Partial to his opinions regarding the matter, Juan Lugo accepted termination in lieu of his silence. Fortunately for the United States of America, he kept the keys. Roy Pogue's phone provided Haley with enough evidence to indisputably identify Congressman Woodside as the Storm's spiritual leader and chief architect of a new white nation. Unencrypted emails on the CID agent's device confirmed as much. Haley had time only for a cursory investigation of the congressman. Information available online revealed that Woodside was born and raised in Howard County, the son of a struggling cattle rancher. Following high school graduation and a few years helping his dad out on the ranch, he received his degree from UTEP and then immediately joined the Marines and its officer candidate course. After a tour in Iraq and one back in the States, Woodside left the military and partnered with a Marine buddy in a lucrative oil business in Midland. His first attempt running for public office, a highly contentious election to represent Texas's 23rd congressional district, was successful. Divorced, Congressman Woodside's advertised hobbies are hunting, fishing, and loving the proud state of Texas. On the drive from El Paso, Lugo provided Haley with a detailed briefing of the ranch and the main residence's layout. He described the round-the-clock security team that keeps watch of the ranch's entry gate and the compound situated 2 miles up a private road. Given the emergent conspiracy, it's not a stretch to imagine Woodside has augmented his personal security team with troops from the National Guard. Haley has no way of knowing for sure. She hopes Andrew Wilde will come through with promised satellite imaging, but stopping to wait for it isn't an option. Haley is determined to get to Woodside with or without help from the deeper state. Once the secessionists have all of their elements in place, the congressman and his cabal will be extremely difficult to dislodge. And untouchable. She'll never again get the opportunity to confront Woodside with questions about her dad. The JW7 Ranch's ex-foreman is intimately familiar with every acre of the entire spread. No one knows the place and its secrets better than Juan Lugo. Without him, Haley has no idea how she could put Woodside in the Warhawk's iron sights. But the plan, devised on the drive from Sierra Blanca to Balmoray, is a good one. Get me inside the fence. You can stay with the vehicles, then I'll come back to you. Juan Lugo is 72 years old. He favors the M1 because he carried the carbine in the Vietnam War. Fighting and living alongside Popular Forces militia members in rural hamlets as a Marine in the Combined Action Program, Lugo traded for the weapon with a militia member who carried the World War II-era rifle. 50 years ago, he preferred the carbine's reliable, lightweight simplicity, and today he still does. IBM manufactured the M1 he carried in Vietnam. After returning from that conflict, Lugo bought one made by Rockola, a company more famously known for making jukeboxes. Beyond answering Haley's numerous questions about the ranch and offering his thoughts on their improvised operation, Juan Lugo has barely spoken a dozen words. Lost in his thoughts, he's a pressure cooker of barely contained fury. Haley can see she is wasting her breath by suggesting he stay in the car. The old man will do as he wishes. With this common resolve, Haley Chill and the old man share an affinity for vengeance. As they drive in silence, the deeper state operative recalls the tumultuous events of the past 9 days. The shootout in Timothy Hooker's trailer in New Mexico. Christian Libby's leap off the Army hospital rooftop. The gladiatorial games staged by the Texas Army National Guard Major, Nathaniel Culberson. Cecil Drummond's gold-tipped pen as she jammed it into his ear. These grim memories, and the more recent deaths of General Killebrew and Roy Pogue, seem a high price to pay for James Woodside's name. So be it. Haley has come this far. Her objective is clear. To slow or stop the secessionist movement with a decapitation strike. But time is short. The full brunt of the 1st Armored Division will be in Midland, Odessa within hours. Once military personnel are in place, the game is essentially over. The Permian Basin's vast oil riches will be in rebels' hands by sunrise tomorrow. Dislodging those elements will be a terrible, bloody, and drawn-out affair. Haley would not be surprised if she learns the secessionists have active sympathizers among the tactical fighter wing at Holloman Air Force Base, less than 90 miles north of Fort Bliss. What a few F-16 Fighting Falcons could do for the secessionists' cause is frightening to imagine. Will Congressman Woodside have any information to impart about her father? The fact that both served in Iraq as Marines holds promise of new revelations. Haley Chill tempers those expectations, however. Stay focused on the task at hand. Be prepared for all contingencies. And, as her father would say, hope for a little luck. He waits in the library of the Stone Manor. The decor is a comfort to Oswald, feeling a deep resonance with the unabashed masculinity expressed by the leather upholstery, muted light, and glassy-eyed animal heads mounted on the paneled walls. Despite the room's welcoming comfort, however, the former Marine is anxious in these long minutes of waiting for U.S. Congressman James Woodside to enter. The Storm's unquestioned leader presided over a larger meeting an hour earlier, in a basement conference room meticulously designed to resemble the Situation Room in the White House. In that gathering, Woodside attempted to calm the nerves of the movement's top commanders, all of whom were unsettled by the deaths of General Killebrew and other Storm sympathizers so close to operational jump-off. The congressman has always been a charismatic and persuasive speaker. He was able to soothe the anxieties of his commanders and effectively delegate those mission responsibilities left exposed by the general's death. Afterward, as the others quickly departed the ranch to attend their assigned duties, Woodside asked Oswald to wait for additional instructions in the private library upstairs. Sitting on the leather couch, he studies framed photographs on the opposite wall that are a testament to James Woodside's meteoric rise since his return from Iraq. Framed photographs capture his intense gaze and inscrutable smile, with the Texas congressman in the company of presidents, industry titans, athletic superstars, and Hollywood celebrities. Not bad for a former Marine officer representing a hardscrabble district in Congress. But Woodside's magnetic personality and ability to connect with an audience is the rocket fuel of his ascendancy. Like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, at least when measured by political and cultural impact, the freshman congressman from Texas's 23rd District is a proficient master of social media and catnip for cable news producers everywhere. Articulate, his message is reducible to a few easily digested ideas. Washington, D.C. isn't America. The government has forsaken us. Self-determination is the consequence of a determined self. These pithy messages, coupled with Woodside's dynamic presence, find resonance with a formidable percentage of the country's adult population and political intelligentsia. The debacle of the Monroe administration and chaos resulting from the global pandemic have only intensified the congressman's appeal, creating a hospitable environment for anti-government sentiment. Sustained instability in the U.S. was too perfect an opportunity for a man of Woodside's megalomania to ignore. But mere politics, the slog of congressional debate and compromise, is an insufficient tool with which to make significant change. Brute force is required. Insurrection, the only way forward. In the Storm Movement, Woodside's singular genius was an instinct to meld the primal motivations of nationalism, white supremacy, and a long-standing otherness of the people in the region. In fact, the congressman harbors no racist inclination, but rather exploits that passion as a fuel to further his own ambitions. Hate as a useful intoxicant. By his estimation, people are small things, the victims of their own fears and inbred prejudices. James Woodside's drive comes from an insatiable desire for power, for immortality. A city named after him, a state, his face on paper money. What his father forever denied him. Approval and respect. The great man and founding father of the free states of America enters the library, as with every room and situation, having the intention of making history. His aura is undeniable. So, too, an impenetrable force field of self-confidence.
Thanks for staying, Peter. I know you have a lot to do over the next 24 hours.
James Woodside is not a tall man, but trim and fit. His amber eyes are golden marbles that capture anyone in their gaze and hold them with an otherworldly gravitational pull. That allure comes not only from his physical appearance, one shared with any number of former military types who see the denial of the aging process as a matter of arrogant pride. Woodside commands via his psychological presence, a man who inhabits every moment as if it's his last. In his orbit, one comprehends the omnipresent authority of a gargantuan outsize willpower. That he lost the thumb on his left hand in Iraq hasn't slowed him down one bit. Oswald leaps to his feet with the arrival of Woodside, who is at least 20 years his junior.
Thank you, sir. Happy to be here. How can I be of service?
The great man sits in an old Morris chair that belonged to his father, upholstered in leather, of course. Oswald takes his seat again after a deferential pause.
As we discussed downstairs, losing General Killebrew has presented several challenges, given the timing, of course.
Yes, sir.
He was also like a father to me, you understand? My real dad never...
Woodside doesn't finish the thought.
Oswald respectfully stares down at the floor, giving the great man his moment.
The congressman takes it to compose himself. Clear-eyed again, Woodside says,
I'm certain these next few hours will proceed as planned, thanks to the efforts of brave men and women like you.
Thank you, sir. It's an incredible honor to play a role of any significance in the movement.
Project Ace in the Hole, Peter. That element of the operation requires real dedication, an unshakable belief in our cause.
Yes, sir.
I'd like you to be in charge of it, my friend. I want you to be our ace in the hole.
Oswald strives to mask his surprise.
I was set to transition to overseeing the morale operations branch, sir. Troops on civilian train transports will be arriving in Midland, Odessa tomorrow, 0700 hours.
He pauses, then says with more emphasis,
Congressman, these folks need to be told what the hell they're doing there.
James Woodside nods gravely.
Swaying our enlisted men to our cause is vital to ensuring the success of our overall operation, of course. But this other assignment, Peter, without it, we face inevitable defeat, despite all of our achievements thus far.
Oswald stands, spine straight and arms flattened to his sides, at attention.
I'd be more than honored to have that duty. For you, sir. Anything. Not me, my friend. For the cause. For the free states of America. Yes, sir. Yes, of course.
Out of the corner of his eye, Oswald sees a young woman standing in a doorway that leads to a part of the house he had never seen in a dozen visits. He had observed the girl at the ranch before on those occasions and wondered who she was. When Oswald glances in that direction, the figure has disappeared. Sensing the same presence, James Woodside stands to his feet as well. Oswald follows the great man toward the doors that lead to the home's entry hall, where three private contractors, all with special forces backgrounds, wait for the storm's founder to emerge. Woodside walks Oswald to the big double doors that lead outside.
We are on the cusp of realizing all our dreams, Peter. We are not only witnesses to history, but the creators of our destiny.
Though Oswald has heard the great man utter these words on multiple occasions in the past few months, he feels his heart rate quicken. Arrested by those strange golden eyes, he can only nod gravely and affirm.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Stepping out onto the massive wraparound porch, Oswald leans into a buffeting gust of wind. The sky at dusk is a shroud of fast-moving black clouds.
Going to storm, he thinks. Better get on the road.
540 miles to the northeast, Greg Lyle sits before a bank of computer monitors in the Storm Prediction Center on the campus of the University of Oklahoma in Norman. Thin, bald, and bespectacled, he has worked for the Weather Service for 29 years. Forecasting weather is his occupation and his passion, buttressed by talents that are considerable. For all of those reasons, his managers tend to listen when Greg Lyle talks, which isn't all that often. He's more interested in studying satellite pictures, forecasting models, surface observations, and radar data than trading the scuttlebutt with office colleagues or visiting the chat rooms that link Weather Service offices across the country. Lyle prefers to go it alone, feeling a personal connection with a galaxy of data that goes with predicting the weather. For the past 2 hours, information being sent to Weather Service computers every 2 seconds by instruments affixed to a 6-foot-wide latex weather balloon released by the NWS office in El Paso has captured the forecaster's attention. Lyle has seen every kind of severe weather event one can expect to see in a lifetime of study. And what he sees on his monitors, in the satellite imagery and reports from the ground, registers in his facial expression. Greg Lyle, NWS veteran, is deeply concerned. The main room in the Storm Prediction Center resembles NASA's Mission Control, with forecasters and researchers seated at long tables. Communication and the sharing of ideas is encouraged by the layout. The forecaster at the next station over from Lyle's is a relative newcomer, with only 10 years of experience. Margie O'Keefe suspects her colleague's reticence around her is due to his distrust of a woman in the SPC. She is wrong in this assumption. Lyle is simply shy. Despite their less-than-convivial work relationship, O'Keefe is compelled to speak when she sees the look on the veteran forecaster's face.
Greg, what's up?
But Lyle doesn't answer. He's already picking up the phone to call the chief of forecast operations. A bulletin needs to be issued, immediately. Warning of the high risk for extreme weather in Reeves County, Texas. The Storm Prediction Center has issued similar high-risk day bulletins 7 times in the past decade. The rental car won't be able to handle the unimproved roads they need to traverse in their final approach to the ranch, a fact made only more obvious by low storm clouds hurtling overhead and intermittent rain squalls. The old man called before they left El Paso and made arrangements with a former employee who could lend them the use of a John Deere Gator all-terrain utility vehicle. Stopping in front of the man's brick-and-wood ranch-style home outside Balmoray, Haley puts the rental car in park and turns off the ignition as Juan Lugo climbs out, carbine in hand. He walks to the Gator parked on the driveway and checks the contents of a gunny sack in the cargo bin. The utility vehicle's owner, a thin, wiry man of indeterminate age with a long beard and wild hair, steps out of the house and, without a word of greeting, tosses his former boss the keys. Haley joins the old man in the gator, her .45 caliber again riding comfortably in its holster. Hunched against a now-drenching rain, Haley buttons the freshly store-bought Levi's jacket to her neck. In her head, she works through an impromptu plan conceived during the ride east. Juan Lugo stows the M1 carbine in the gap between the two molded plastic seats. Within moments of arriving in the stayed rental car, they're off and running in the feisty all-terrain vehicle. A stiff wind blows, kicking up debris. Taking FM 3078 south, the two-lane farm-to-market road runs to the east of vast JW7 Ranch. Crossing the Wolfter Draw, the old man steers the gator off the pavement 2 miles short of the gravel road that leads to the ranch's seldom-used east gate, and continues west, across the desert and hidden from the view of roving security personnel. Though the all-terrain vehicle bounces over the rutted and rock-strewn open ground without a problem, Haley is relieved when they transition to an actual packed dirt road the width of a single car. The ex-foreman knows every path and roadway the ranch has to offer. Though the rain has stopped for now, overall the weather has deteriorated. Worse is yet to come. Any water that has already fallen from the sky was absorbed by the parched earth. Lugo registers Haley's anxiety. Gesturing at the angry clouds swirling overhead, he says,
"Derecho."
The word is new to her.
Spanish for straight. A straight-line windstorm. Very sudden. Widespread. Comes with tremendous winds. Torrential rain, hail, and tornadoes.
He points to what looks like a miles-long towering black shelf in the sky to the west.
Derecho.
Haley nods, no less determined than before. Relieved, the old man is similarly undeterred. With the deeper state operative shielding her eyes against swirling particulates in the air, Lugo reaches into a door compartment and fishes out a pair of cheap plastic goggles. She is inclined to decline the gift, but registers disapproval in his facial expression. Slipping on the goggles brings immediate relief. Haley glances toward the old man, who seems oblivious to the blast of sand and grit, imagining his eyes are made of dark, hard glass. 10 minutes after following the single track west, it peters out. The old man confidently steers the gator over open ground until they come to a high game fence composed of high tensile steel mesh. The gate is padlocked, and an abundance of overgrown weeds suggests infrequent use. Juan Lugo climbs out and approaches the gate while Haley slides over behind the wheel of the gator. Once he has opened the padlock and swung the gate wide, she drives through as he closes it behind her. Haley slides back over as the old man gets back behind the ATV's steering wheel.
"I'd asked the previous owner to install 6 additional access gates in addition to the 3 on the paved roads leading onto the property. Didn't want to have to drive 4 miles in either direction if there was a good reason to get on the other side of the fence. I'm the only one who has a key. Woodside probably doesn't even know these extra gates exist."
Inside the ranch's perimeter, finally, the main residence is still 3 miles distant. Lugo points to the northwest.
"The main road, coming south from the interstate, is that way. They'll have that road guarded. Behind us, the road coming from the east, they'll be watching that one too. We're due east of the house now. Between us and them is the hydrofracking well."
Haley nods. For the time being, she is only a passenger. If any structure can withstand the damaging high winds brought on by a West Texas high-risk storm, it's the main residence of the JW7 Ranch. Sturdy as a blockhouse, the thick stone walls are impervious to the tempest's blast. But the roof's hold on the structure is less secure. Windows, too, seem of insufficient sturdiness. James Woodside has retired to his bedroom suite upstairs after an abbreviated meal, leaving the private security contractors to gather on the porch and bear witness to the weather's burgeoning fury. Buffeted by the gusts, the men grip a handrail for support. Each man is armed with holstered pistols, slung long guns, or both. Their demeanor is relaxed. Miles from the closest public road and with both gates guarded, their biggest worry is the weather. The rumble of thunder gathers until it reaches a violent crescendo, a clattering noise that bounces across the surrounding hills. One and all, the operators feel almost like young boys again. Jesus. Wind swirls. Undulating clouds the color of bruised flesh threaten to funnel. Rain again begins to pelt the ground, kicking up minute explosions of mud.
Anybody ever ride out a tornado before?
None of the mercenaries seem particularly keen about the prospect, despite the great home's stone walls. These men have seen combat. All have killed other men in battle. They are familiar with the stink, sweat, and spurting blood of close-quarters combat. But this night of multiple storms is a different experience. A power over which they have no control has rattled them. One beyond the reach of their weapons. Craving the relative security of the indoors, they turn for the home's entrance. A much different rumbling noise from over the hills to the east stops them in their tracks.
What the hell was that?
The unit leader, known only as Jones, returns to the porch railing and peers in the direction where the rumble continues to echo.
That's an explosion.
Another rolling thunderclap unravels overhead from the west. Are their senses deceiving them?
I'm not sure, says one of the men. Sounded just like thunder.
Another says,
the fucking wind playing tricks.
Jones looks like every other Special Forces veteran. Ball cap, beard, athletic build. Intense. Survival doesn't happen by accident. Preparation, planning, execution. The unit leader isn't only good. Jones excels in all aspects of security and military operations. Protecting James Woodside isn't ideological for him or any of the others. Professional pride is at stake. They don't even know about the Cabal's agenda or planned secession from the United States. Would it make any difference to the operators if they did? Most likely not. None of the men are familiar with Woodside or his ambitions. They only know the man has a taste for young women. They may judge him for those proclivities, but keep those thoughts to themselves. After all, they're professionals. Jones retrieves his cell phone and is relieved to see he has a signal despite the foul weather. Whether thunder or explosion, he's unwilling to roll the dice. His lieutenant at the north gate answers after one ring.
Leave two men there. The rest of you come to the main house.
He disconnects the call and is turning to speak with the man standing next to him when the 30-caliber carbine 110-grain full metal jacket round, traveling at slightly under 1,500 feet per second, strikes Jones in the side of his head, just above the right ear, and pulverizes much of the cranium. With kinetic energy to spare, the projectile ricochets off the vestiges of Jones's cranial plate and hits another mercenary in the neck and buries itself in his spine. The man is immediately paralyzed. Within minutes, he will be dead. A second shot and third shot from Juan Lugo's M1 carbine follow in rapid succession, each finding a target in the heads of a third and fourth security contractor. The old man has rarely let a week pass by since his days as a Marine sniper in Vietnam, without a few hours on the range. He has never forgotten the words of the Rifleman's Creed, and lives by them still. My rifle is human, even as I, because it is my life. Lugo's connection with his near-ancient carbine is real. Today it serves him, and Haley Chill, as well can be expected given the circumstances. Fourth, fifth, and sixth shots miss the two surviving mercenaries who drop to the porch floor and push open the front door to re-enter the residence. In the few seconds of that journey from outside to inside the house, the surviving mercenaries comprehend some obvious facts. That they are under attack. That they were foolish to gather on the porch, grouped together like idiots. These survivors of the initial surprise attack cling to the expectation of reinforcements their now slain unit leader summoned from the main gate only moments earlier. Unaware, the explosion they all heard has released a fresh torrent across the private road from the gate. Those reinforcements will never come. They are also unaware, only for another moment longer, that a woman, with blonde hair and powder blue eyes, stands over them now, Warhawk in hand. waiting for them inside their false sanctuary.
Don't move.
Then, more emphatically, don't do it. She holds her aim between them, finger off the trigger, waiting for their reaction. What's it going to be? Smart or not? The old man had provided her with the key and a detailed description of the house's layout. Basement door at the rear of the structure unlocked, Haley had crept upstairs undetected and stayed out of sight until she heard the distant wireless detonation of a single C4 block, provided to Lugo by his former ranch hand. After leaving the fence line and crossing rows of chaparral-covered hills, Haley and the old man stopped at the hydrofracking water well site. Lugo set explosives at the wellhead and at the bases of twin mammoth galvanized steel water tanks, holding a combined 900,000 gallons of water. Between the sudden release from the destroyed tanks and ruptured wellhead, the water flooding the road below ensured no one would be accessing the ranch's main residence anytime soon. Once they arrived within a quarter mile of the big house, Lugo set up a sniper hide in the wooded hill above, while Haley approached from a seasonally dry creek bed to the rear. The old man remotely detonated the explosives only when he had a clear shot at the men gathered recklessly on the porch. Having taken refuge inside the great house's entry hall, one of the two operators rolls at the sound of the female intruder's voice and brings his M16 around. Haley shoots him in the top of his skull. The other man, lying on his Glock in a side holster, reaches for a backup gun barely visible under his right pant cuff. "Are they paying you enough to die?" Haley asks him, then puts another round into the chest of the first man, making sure. Making a point. The second operator says nothing. "You are paid, right? Do you even know what these people are trying to do?" He is a former Special Missions Unit Delta Force. On Sundays, back home in Florida, he likes to golf with Army buddies. Has an ex-wife and one current. His daughter starts at the University of Miami in the fall. A guilty pleasure is the masked singer. Moments before the diversionary explosion, the man was thinking about an omelet he had had for breakfast in Balmoray. That it had been pretty damn good. The mercenary decides he isn't being paid enough to die. Nope. He slowly moves his hand as far away as possible from the gun strapped to his ankle. Haley says, "Good." Juan Lugo enters through the front door, M1 carbine in hand and backpack strung over his shoulders. The storm's wind blast and a renewed torrential rain follows him inside, abated only by the old man closing the door behind him. He exchanges a look with Haley and then silently collects the weapons scattered on the floor.
"Roll over,"
he says to the sole surviving mercenary, retrieving the Glock and then the SIG P365 backup. Working quickly, no doubt displaying skills acquired from a lifetime working on farms and ranches throughout the state, Lugo hogties the mercenary with rope from his backpack. Haley squats down beside the man.
"Is he armed?"
she asks him. The operator is merely glad to be alive.
"Isn't everybody?"
Haley nods, barely.
"Where?"
"Upstairs, last I knew. He could be in Timbuktu by now, for all I know."
She stands, looks to the old man. His expression telegraphs sadness, an infinity of pain.
"You ready, sir?"
"Yes."
Leaving the mercenary tied up on the entry hall floor, Haley and Juan Lugo turn and climb the staircase. They find James Woodside in the master bedroom. The girl with black hair and dark eyes barely looks her 15 years. They sit on the end of the king-size bed facing the door. The revolver in his hand is ornate, almost ceremonial. His left arm is draped casually, proprietarily, around her shoulders. Haley looks to the old man, gauging his reaction to the sight before them. Lugo is without words, tears filling his eyes. The girl is crying as well. She says,
"Grandpa?"
"Kimberly," says the old man.
Kimberly of the Flyers, on leaflets left throughout El Paso. A motif of Haley Chill's journey through the looking glass. Kimberly, the teenage runaway, of navy UTEP hoodie, possessing the kind of innocent, sweet beauty that is achingly tenuous and fragile. All there still. Almost intact. Under Woodside's arm, his pistol pointing at her gut. Haley recognized her almost immediately when reviewing photos she had found on Roy Pogue's phone. She has no idea how the CID agent came to have the photos in his possession. Given the innate antagonism between a black man and someone trying to create an all-white nation, it's easy to comprehend why Pogue might gather compromat on the FSA's presumptive president. The girl's haunting photograph on leaflets all over El Paso was an apparition that followed Haley throughout her investigation. An obscene snapshot of the teenager with Woodside was the vital connection to Juan Lugo, who answered the phone when she called the number listed on the flyer in her car. Without Lugo, Haley would not be here. The truth within reach. She says, "Let her go." With these words, the deeper state operative takes aim on the ethmoid bone in Woodside's face. From 10 feet, she will not miss. To everyone's surprise but his own, Woodside removes his left arm from the girl's shoulders and drops his right hand down so that the revolver is pointed at the floor.
"Of course."
The teenager stands and runs to her grandfather, folding into his embrace. As one, they turn and disappear out the door, trailed by the eruption of her sobs. Haley listens to their footsteps down the grand staircase just outside the master bedroom door. She has not moved the gun off her target. Her finger remains on the trigger. Through the pre-travel, to the wall. "Drop the gun on the floor. Slowly." Woodside does as he's commanded, carefully bending over to place the pistol on the rug at the bed's foot. Rain and wind crash against the 6 windows that line the 2 walls of the expansive bedroom. The storm outside rages. Another crash of thunder, a flash of lightning, even more wind and rain. Haley recalls her last image of her father, hanging by his neck from his bedroom door, shirtless. An ignoble death. James Woodside knows the why and what of Tommy Chill's death. She has never been more confident of a hunch than this one. He knows. He was born and raised in West Texas, his father owning a ranch north of Big Spring where he bred quarter horses and black and white Tobiano paint horses. Jim Woodside was a confident, happy-go-lucky child, sharing with his fun-loving mother a natural gift for singing. The family fortunes changed in an instant with the death of his younger brother, kicked in the head by a surly mare. Jim's mother took off for Florida 6 months later, and then it was just the two of them. A suddenly morose boy and his mostly silent father. Badgering his remaining son to help out with the livestock, Earl Woodside imagined they might still make a go of a diminished enterprise. To his eternal dismay, however, the boy never relinquished a dream of becoming a country western singer. Their battles were epic. Only with the onset of his father's stage 4 pancreatic cancer was James Woodside free to pursue his musical aspirations. Unfortunately, with no more than a mediocre talent, the young man's artistic goals went unrealized. He spent many months as a vagabond and found mentorship with Carter Shaw, a white supremacist and ex-con who gave the 19-year-old a sense of belonging. Virulently racist, Shaw strove to indoctrinate Woodside with his beliefs. His charge, however, was more preoccupied with his unrequited desires for fame and fortune. The 19-year-old country crooner paid only lip service to the idolatry of hatred. It was that diffidence, and an opportune flu bug, that kept the future congressman from joining his mentor and 2 friends in the lynching by dragging murder of a local black man. But the die was cast. James Woodside joined the military and excelled, ultimately applying for officer candidate school and attaining the rank of major in Iraq, enduringly cognizant of the energizing and dynamic power of a racist message. Woodside asks,
"Who are you?"
The silence between them lasted only a few moments, but Haley felt as if an eternity had passed. Juan Lugo will return, for unfinished business. She doesn't have much time.
I'm Haley Chill. My father was Thomas Chill. He lived for the last 15 years of his life, give or take, as Charles Hicks, working as a civilian in the Pentagon. Before that, he was a Marine with 2 tours in Iraq. You're going to tell me what happened to my dad, and you're going to stop whatever it is your group has planned here in the Permian.
If Woodside is surprised by any part of Haley's statement, he doesn't betray it. He is utterly calm and composed, having the attitude of a man who has accomplished his ultimate goals.
There's no stopping it. The machine is in motion, designed to operate autonomously. Killing me will not affect the outcome.
Well, I guess we'll see about that. She bends down to retrieve his revolver from the floor, stands erect again.
And my father?
You knew him.
Woodside says,
Tommy was my friend. Saved my life, in fact. It was on our first deployment, the invasion of Iraq in 2003. We had taken Baghdad, the Army's 3rd Infantry and us. 5 days after entering the city, there was a rumor that Saddam Hussein and his top aides were holed up in a mosque in the Al-Azamiyah district. 3 companies went in. All came under heavy fire. Rocket-propelled grenades, mortars, and assault rifles. One of our guys killed. 20 wounded. Never found Saddam anywhere. Tommy pushed me behind a wall and fell on top of me when an RPG nearly took off the back of my skull. The blast did a number on both of us, but we were good to go after a few minutes. Your dad was a good Marine. Anybody over there would say that.
Haley hears this with a placid expression. She hasn't chased Woodside through hell for war stories.
What happened over there? What really happened?
Woodside stares at her, mute. She asks, How was he part of this?
My father was no racist.
No, Tommy wasn't a racist. But he came to understand what his government had done to him, how it used him, used all of us. He and Charlie wanted to do something about it.
Charlie Hicks.
Haley's last vestiges of hope begin to crumble away. Her father died a traitor to the country she loves. He betrayed every ideal she holds dear.
Oh God, did Dad kill a fellow Marine?
Why did he take Charles Hicks's identity? Why abandon his family?
Woodside's face registers his surprise.
You don't know.
I don't know what.
He sighs, the awareness of his imminent, glorious demise settling on him like a warm blanket. The congressman from Texas will always be remembered as the founding father of a new and prosperous nation. As George Washington's name is for the ages, so will be the name James Earl Woodside.
Tommy backed out. Charlie, too, once they understood. When they saw how far we wanted to take this. After we folded in the fellows with white nationalist agendas, Tommy and Charlie wanted no part of the storm or its goals after that, of seceding from the United States. But they knew too much by that point. They were too involved. Others in our movement wanted them dead. A trivial matter in the theater of war. We eliminated many of our adversaries in a similar fashion. KIA, as it were. But I owed your father my life. I considered him a friend.
Juan Lugo appears in the doorway behind Haley, alone. She feels his presence there, waiting. Woodside sees him too, of course. Her prayers have been answered. Too soon, though, to process it all. Not yet. But her relief is apparent.
My father didn't abandon his family.
He saved us.
James Woodside says nothing. His silence is answer enough. Lugo takes a step forward. He draws a hunting knife, the 4-inch blade of Damascus steel, from a sheath on his leather belt. The deeper state operative holds out her hand, not finished with Woodside.
something she can't understand.
He came west, to Texas.
Tommy sniffed out our plans. Like you on his fishing expedition, putting his nose where it didn't belong. I couldn't protect him any longer. After that point, no one could have helped Tommy.
She understands now. What she had always desired is now hers. The truth.
He didn't kill himself?
The possibility reverberates from the soles of her feet to the top of her skull, becomes conviction.
He didn't kill himself.
Woodside's eyes leave Haley and shifts to the old man standing next to her, of grave expression. He with the remorseless gaze. A dire wolf.
Hello, Juan. It's good to see you again, my friend.
Who? Haley asks Woodside. Who did you send? He moves his gaze off the old man and back on her, as if describing the weather, or a particularly ordinary day on the golf course.
For Tommy? One of my best men. Obedient. Loyal. You'll never find him.
The congressman considers leaving it at that, but arrogance gets the better of him. A supreme faith in his chosen apostles.
Oswald. So extraordinarily ordinary. Has that elusive quality. Like smoke.
Haley stands still for another moment, the scene too difficult to break in its perfect triangulating symmetry. Then she steps backward, turns, and walks out of the room, leaving fury to do its work. Kimberly is waiting for Haley in the library. Though the worst of the storm has passed to the northeast, strong winds and rain continue to pound the windows. Lamps with dark, heavy shades cast the room in a masculine gloom. The teenager seems to be okay. Eyes are red from crying and her hair is a mess. But Kimberly Chacon is a strong young woman who was pulled into the unyielding darkness and survived. Haley stops in the open doorway, glancing back over her shoulder to the one surviving mercenary who lies tied up at the foot of the staircase. He remains securely immobilized. But God only knows what noises will descend from the upstairs bedroom in the next seconds. Not the soundtrack a teenage girl needs to carry with her through the rest of her life. Haley gestures to Kimberly. We should wait outside. But the teenager remains rooted in place, staring at an artifact hanging on the wall. Haley enters the room and joins Kimberly in front of what she can see now is a historical document framed and under protective glass. Within a few seconds, Haley comprehends that she is looking at an original manuscript of the Declaration of Independence by the Republic of Texas, signed in 1836.
This, says the girl. You want this?
Haley is puzzled, not understanding why Kimberly has brought the artifact to her attention. But then she recalls seeing the same document, cheaply self-published and of recent vintage, in the trailer at the New Mexico compound. And she gets it. Retrieving her phone, the Deeper State operative snaps three photographs of the framed document. Satisfied she has captured every word, Haley puts her hand lightly on the girl's arm. Let's go.